So it's good to have a federal standard.
Right. But at the same time, is federal government sufficiently close to the ground to understand the ramifications of certain laws within particular jurisdictions? And as a result, will their laws represent particular needs of those communities at the lower level? So in I think lower level governments are a bit more intimate with the workings of the state within their particular jurisdiction, and as a result may be able to enact laws that may suit their geographical area. So I would think, looking at it from the perspective, there are merits in allowing the provinces and also that's just what I said.
Well, that's a very good point, because different areas of the country may have different issues where people feel that there ought to be a criminal law to address local issues, or perhaps the criminal law that is meant for the whole country is not really appropriate in that particular area. And you gave the example of the adult entertainment, not education, entertainment. and how that's an issue that may be more prevalent in Toronto and Montreal and Windsor than other parts of the country. And so is the federal criminal law really something that is appropriate for the whole country? Does it really address local issues in an adequate fashion or not?
Right, but I think that the federal government...
And this is why if the local governments feel it's not adequate, they try to find bylaws, or the provinces try to find legislation that really addresses the provincial or the local issue, and then sometimes those are struck down as interfering with the federal criminal jurisdiction. Yes?
But I think both tiers of government should be able to pass laws that can deal with the same issue, mm-hmm. but different aspects.
Mm-hmm.
That's just my opinion.
Yeah, so with regard to the province, they can pass legislation that deals with health issues, not morality issues, and feds do morality, but not the health. Yes?
I just finished reading Judge Shirelli from Alberta, I think. He was provincial about morally reserved.
Mm-hmm.
And he fought for many years to introduce in his writings in court the conditions of First Nations and how it's actually affecting the results of them being criminal.
Yep. Perpetuating the problem.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So I think there would be interest in having local consideration for federal criminal.
Yeah. And as a matter of fact, the federal government does amend the criminal code to allow for local conditions in certain situations, for example, allowing for sentencing circles in native communities, either on or off reserves.
Yeah, he was saying that they did. However, when it went to appeal, it was struck down. So it goes so far, but then the problem is still sort of, it's not well established
yeah.
for use.
Mm-hmm. And that's a good point in relation to Aboriginal issues in particular. So I think that's a very good point. And much of it has to do with I guess local input into the federal lawmaking system, to see if you can bring about some flexibility for local problems. But then also framing the legislation in such a way that it's not likely to be struck down, which is another issue. Any other comments about that? Yes?
I think having the criminal code as a federal is appropriate, because it creates sort of also a sense of identity of throughout the entire land, as opposed to even to be provincial. I do agree with Junior's point that there has to be a balance between the local issues that arise and how that fits within the general criminal code. But I think because, for example, Weber was the one that talked about the state being defined as the monopoly of violence, how it uses violence, or you know what I mean, how it enforces things. And I think having that sense all throughout the land, having that uniformity for those limits, I think creates a sense of identity and it helps at the same time with the interprovincial guidelines of how certain issues should be dealt with.
Mm-hmm. The other thing that is really important, as Judy pointed out, is it's really up to the provinces to enforce the federal criminal code. So in the case of Morgenthaler, for example, at one point, the Quebec government said, we're not going to enforce the federal criminal code with regard to abortion anymore. We're not going to prosecute. So the feds can't force them to prosecute. So just looking back at the bargain of Confederation in 1867, giving the feds the power to make the criminal law and the provinces the power to enforce it, is perhaps an ingenious way of dividing powers. Judy, did you have any other questions? Good. Well, thank you for that wonderful presentation. R.J.R. MacDonald, just to comment on your commentary on R.J.R. MacDonald, I want to ask everybody here, do you think that it's a justifiable use of the criminal code for the feds to regulate tobacco advertising? Now, advertising would normally be within the provincial sphere because it's a business. But the Supreme Court said, because it's been proven that smoking is really harmful, and therefore there's a public safety issue here and a public health issue, this is a valid use of the criminal code. Yes?
I think that opens the doors to a lot of different things, like advertising for fast food.
Mm-hmm. Yes?
To be a health concern for children, or advertising for various things, so I think, or for alcohol as well, I mean, it could be seen as a danger to, society.
Mm-hmm. You're absolutely right about that. Is that good or bad?
Well, I think, I don't know.
If there's legislation with regard to trans fats in the food, is it useful to know that wherever you go in Canada that the same standards apply? Or is it okay to let the provinces have different standards and see which one does it the best? Yes?
I think this kind of comes back to what Carlos was mentioning about a set of Canadian values, and mm-hmm. how that feeds into the sense of a national identity.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So I think consistency is an important factor there.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm weary of any of these kinds of slippery slope arguments, because like in this particular case, I would argue that it actually is a good idea maybe to legislate against fast food advertisement or trans fat advertisement,
mm-hmm.
those types of things. But I think that going back to what Carlos brought up, this notion of a unified value set does seem important to me as far as perpetuating some kind of national identity. Mm-hmm. And this came up a bit in the reaction to the Shafia case, the recent mm-hmm. Shafia case, with the wording of the ruling of the judge, talking about, he kind of had some colorful language describing the notion mm-hmm. of honor killings. But I see that as more of reflecting a general sense of Canadian values, which I think is an important role of federal government, and especially in the Canadian context, the way that the federal government is kind of set up initially almost in opposition to the interests of the provinces mm-hmm. as far as establishing a feedback mechanism. So I think mm-hmm. a strong stance on morality, or in this case, consumption of goods, right, whether or not they're good or bad for you, is important just to have a consistent general consensus as far as national identity is concerned.
Mm-hmm. I think that's a very good point, because and Trudeau realized that Canadians are not held together by language or culture, but he hoped that we would be held together by a common set of values, which is one of the reasons he wanted a Charter of Rights and Freedoms. And guess what the number one symbol of being Canadian is right across the country? Charter of Rights and Freedoms. So we do seem to have a common set of values there, although they They're probably interpreted differently everywhere. But guess where the charter is the most important Canadian value? Quebec. So it seems to have worked. I think you had a comment?
I'm just curious a bit what Dave was saying, where a lot of polls have shown Canadians to be very central in the way the values they adopt. Mm-hmm. Whereas we have a drastic political change in the last decade or so, where they're actually shifting the political value to the right, where it doesn't necessarily concord to what people, Canadians as general, would identify as their value. So I'm just wondering, how can we set a national sort of standard based on values when the values aren't necessarily representative of the populace in general? Yes.
Dave?
Well, I think this speaks to a few different issues. One that's close to my heart is proportional representation, mm-hmm. just the way that kind of gerrymandering has gone on over the establishment of the seats in Parliament. Mm-hmm. And so if you got an absolute poll of every individual, right, the results may be different than who actually voted and who won in which constituencies. And I think that as far as perpetuating a unified sense that isn't necessarily tied specifically to the political swings that we may or may not have. I think things like court decisions and popular culture aren't as volatile as, say, who's in control of Parliament for a certain amount of years. So things like the trending of court decisions or the general sense of things in public opinion or music or TV or those types of things, if that kind of thing can forge a Canadian identity aside from maybe the political realities of, you know, left versus right or center versus center right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's a very big discussion when we talk about Canadian values, but it's interesting thinking of the criminal law as being part of that discussion. I'd like to move on now to the final readings for today and then get back to some labor relations issues if there's time. So Monahan chapter 12. The Constitution and Transportation. So, as we learned last month, the federal government in Section 91, some of the enumerated sections, has control over interprovincial and international transportation, beacons, buoys, lighthouses, navigation and shipping, ferries outside of one province, Sable Island. Sable Island is off Nova Scotia. It's a very important world heritage site. And nature site, if you haven't heard of it before. And he points out that the criminal power affects motor vehicles, ships, and aircraft. There, in addition to the Provincial Highway Traffic Act, there's federal criminal legislation with regard to dangerous driving, for example, or dangerous driving when drinking. I think that in the last class in January, I did go over section 9210. The provinces are responsible for local works and undertakings, with the exception of 9210C, those declared by Parliament to be within the federal realm, right? And the declaratory power was used about 500 times up until 25 years ago, and it's been dormant ever since, because there would be too much provincial opposition to the feds using it to expand their regulatory power. But it could be used in the future, and it probably will for some industries that there's a consensus that there needs to be federal control. It's interesting, in 1989, the Supreme Court ruled that local and provincial telephone companies come within federal authority. Up until that time, the provinces regulated some telephone companies. Bell was regulated federally because it's Ontario and Quebec. The Alberta government regulated Alberta government telephones. The City of Edmonton regulated City of Edmonton telephones. And that seemed to be the law until 1989. And then the Fed said, nope, it really falls under federal jurisdiction, because when you get on a telephone, it could well be interprovincial or international. So it's really impossible to say it's purely provincial anymore. There's a big change in jurisdiction. Um, The internet is subject to federal regulations under the 9210 exception, and some provincial regulation under 9213. Let me just skip over to the very bottom of this. How many of you have a Canadian driver's license? Yeah, all of you who have a driver's license have a Canadian driver's license. It says Ontario, but you'll see, if you take a look, close look at your driver's license, it also says Canada. I think we went over that last month, which is why you all answered that correctly. The Supreme Court of Canada ruled that interprovincial driver's licenses, that's a federal jurisdiction. The feds didn't want that jurisdiction. So all of the provincial licensing boards were given federal jurisdiction as well, which is why your Ontario driver's license is good anywhere in Canada. Aboriginal issues and federalism. Now, for part five in Monahan, today I'm just covering pages 439 to 460. The rest of it I'll cover next month. I think you've all heard of the Royal Proclamation of 1763. Aboriginal lands are recognized. Lands for settlers would need to be purchased from the Aboriginals by the British government. One of the grievances of the 13 colonies in the United States, the War of Independence, they didn't like that. They thought that they had the right to take over Aboriginal lands, and they strongly objected to the British protection of the Aboriginal lands. Anyway, the Royal Proclamation of 1763, thanks to the amendments in 1962, is now recognized as being part of our Constitution. Now, treaties have been signed both by the British government, by the Canadian government since 1867, and more recently in what is now Northwest Territories and Nunavut, with Aboriginal peoples. There are still many treaties that have not been signed in British Columbia, but more are being negotiated all the time. Until recently, the courts treated the treaties, did I mention this in that last month? They treated the treaties as international law. In other words, the courts will not recognize them unless they are reflected in domestic law, that is federal or provincial law. So although the treaties were signed, until recent years they were not respected, and the provincial and federal governments could disregard them in any way they wanted. That's one of the very important Aboriginal grievances. 1973, the famous Calder case. The Supreme Court of Canada recognized some Aboriginal rights, at least with regard to traditional lands where treaties had not been signed. So this was a very important case because before 1973, the Aboriginal interpretation of the treaties was not recognized by Canadian courts. And the reasoning of the courts was that the Aboriginal peoples were primitive peoples. They didn't have an understanding of law. They didn't have their own system of law. Therefore, the only interpretation of treaties that is valid is the interpretation of treaties by the negotiators for Great Britain or Canada who negotiated the treaties. Recently, there was a diary found by one of, well, when the officials for the Canadian government were negotiating treaties with Aboriginal peoples in Ontario, there was a person who was sent by the Canadian government to keep a record of everything that was discussed. And that included what the Aboriginal people said and what the Canadian negotiators said. That diary was recently found. Until that time, we only had a record of what the Canadian officials had told the government they had negotiated. Now we have a record of the Aboriginal understanding of those treaties. And it is going to affect now that the after Calder, the courts recognize the Aboriginal interpretation of treaties as well is going to affect Aboriginal claims in this province. Marshall case in 1999. I think you discussed the Marshall case in when you were with Professor Sonikin. So it's interesting, the Supreme Court accepted evidence of the Aboriginal understanding of a treaty rather than relying simply on the official British-Canadian interpretation. And the evidence was provided by Professor Wicken in the History Department here at York University. And the evidence he presented, I've seen it, it's about 300 pages long, a very detailed analysis of the Aboriginal understanding of the treaties that were signed in the 1700s. And the majority accepted this as conclusive evidence of the Aboriginal understanding of the treaties. Section 9124 gives the federal government jurisdiction over Indians and lands reserved for the Indians. This means exclusive federal jurisdiction with regard to everything, not including anything in Section 92. So the feds can do anything on Aboriginal reserves. But the feds don't want to legislate with regard to very often issues such as education or health, social services, and so they delegate to the provinces the ability to extend provincial jurisdiction onto the reserves. It's the same for the national parks. Unless the feds explicitly say we don't want provincial regulations and policies to provide to apply on the reserves. So it's a little bit confusing. So in some cases, the provinces, for example, are responsible for education on the reserves. But in some cases, the feds have said, well, it's not good enough in this particular reserve, so we will provide the schools. Yes?
Can the provinces refuse to accept that responsibility?
Yes. Mm-hmm. In which case, there's kind of a vacuum. One reason for the lack of services on many reserves.
Would they get extra funds from the federal government?
Nope. Not usually. So any questions about part five so far? Yes?
The Aboriginal community is quite large.
Mm-hmm. About 4% of Canadians identify as being at least partly Aboriginal. The people who are listed as officially Aboriginal, that is mostly Aboriginal, about 2%. In Saskatchewan, the identification is about 30% and growing.
Yeah, I think I used the wrong word. Not large, really, mm-hmm. but diverse.
Yeah.
So, and in some respects, unclear on identity.
Mm-hmm.
To what degree do you think those treaties signed by one Aboriginal group binding on other Aboriginal groups, are we now opening challenges from other Aboriginal groups who may not agree with what falls under the treaties that are now being recognized. In other words, if the Aboriginal community had 10 different tribes, so to speak, mm-hmm. one tribe signed a treaty, and that book is now found and recognized by the government,
mm-hmm.
and other Aboriginal
the treaties, generally speaking, were signed with very small groups. So there are hundreds and hundreds of treaties. And in general, when the treaties were signed, there was a meeting between the Canadian negotiators or the British negotiators before 1867 and the Aboriginal community. And there was translation going on. And of course, the Aboriginal peoples believe in consensus. So once they got an explanation of what was in the treaty, and there was negotiation back and forth, leaders would only sign if there was a consensus, meaning that everybody's views had been heard, and even if you didn't get everything in it that you wanted, you were willing to go along with it all. But very often the explanation given to the local people was not the understanding of the Canadian negotiators. That was the problem. Today, the more recent treaties in Nunavut, for example, cover much broader areas of land, and there have been disputes between Inuit men and women, for example, about the content of the treaties, and different communities have different views, and so there's a vote, and if the majority approves, then they go ahead with the treaty. They try to get consensus, but they can't always get consensus. But once there is a vote and the treaty is signed, that pretty much settles it.
So what's it like the Aboriginal rights? If the Aboriginal rights conflict mm-hmm. with some of the fundamental rights as outlined in the Charter, mm-hmm. Which would subordinate? For example,
That's a very good question, yeah, because the Charter of Rights and Freedoms itself says that nothing in the Charter is meant to derogate from Aboriginal rights, including the Royal Proclamation of 1763. But on the other hand, the principle of equality in the Charter of Rights and Freedoms applies to all Aboriginal people. Before 1982, there were certainly inequalities between Aboriginal men and Aboriginal women in terms of status, which at that time was supported by the majority of Aboriginal men. Because of the certainty that those inequalities in the Indian Act would be struck down as violating Section 15 of the Charter, the Indian Act was amended. So, like just about everything in law, it's unclear which would take precedence. The Aboriginal rights are supposed to take precedence, but then we have to define what an Aboriginal right is. A right to be treated, to treat men better than women is not a right. Any other questions or comments? So the Ron Corelli case, which all of you have read for today, is one of Canada's most famous cases to illustrate how the rule of law can support human rights. So Dicey's argument, I mentioned Dicey last month. Dicey was very much against constitutionally entrenched bills of rights or charters of rights, because he said that it entrenched understanding of human rights at a particular period of time, subjected them to court interpretation, which was often very conservative, and it made it impossible to move on with promoting human rights. And that was the argument that was prevalent in Canada right up until 1982. This particular case illustrates how the rule of law can work to protect human rights, and still does. So Ron Corelli was a Jehovah's Witness in Quebec. During the 1950s, when the Jehovah's Witnesses were being persecuted by the Quebec provincial government. Now, the Jehovah's Witnesses, I think many of you have had the watchtower brought to your home. The watchtower being distributed in Quebec was very, very insulting towards the Roman Catholic religion. So, since at that time the great majority of Quebecers were Roman Catholics, they objected to this literature being distributed. And they wanted the provincial government to put an end to it. The government of Maurice Duplessis was very authoritarian, not human rights oriented at all. There was provincial legislation that prevented prevented anyone from distributing literature without a permit. The JWs never got a permit. Other people would. So it was specifically directed against or enforced against the Jehovah's Witnesses. Ron Corelli owned a restaurant in downtown Montreal. The restaurant did very well. He made a lot of money. He would post bail for the Jehovah's Witnesses who were charged for distributing literature without a permit. Premier Duplessis didn't like this. So he personally canceled Ron Corelli's liquor license. And of course, as you know from visiting Montreal, any Montreal restaurant that doesn't have a liquor license is not liable to do very well financially. So in the end, Ron Corelli did go bankrupt. But in the meantime, Frank Scott, one of Canada's most famous lawyers and poets, decided that he would represent Duplessis pro bono, that is for free, and helped Ron Corelli sue Duplessis for violation of the rule of law. That is, there was no legislation in Quebec that gave the premier the power to cancel Ron Corelli's liquor license. Now, I think that the premier was acting as the attorney general. The Supreme Court decision, as you read, was quite interesting, because not only did it say that the premier didn't really have the authority to do this, but it went on to say that he couldn't order other government officials to cancel the liquor license, because the law has to be applied fairly, without prejudice, and equally to everyone. So Ron Corelli cannot be singled out for having his liquor license canceled. It's not a discretionary decision, it's a legal decision. So Ron Corelli eventually won his case. It didn't really matter, because by then he'd gone bankrupt and had moved out of the province. But it was a very important symbolic victory for the rule of law. Now, shortly after this, the Duplessis government changed the liquor regulations to allow for the legal cancellation of Ron Corelli's license. That was kind of a moot point, since he'd gone bankrupt already. But shortly after that, the Duplessis government was defeated. The Lesage government came in 1960, and the Quiet Revolution started. But the Ron Corelli case is pointed to as one example of how judges can enforce human rights by defending the rule of law, and how lawyers can defend human rights by taking cases to court where governments arbitrarily violate the rule of law. And as Dicey pointed out, if we're made to suffer for other than violation of the law, that's abuse of power. And as I mentioned last month, one of the purposes of courts is to prevent abuse of power. So any questions or comments about the Ron Corelli case? Yes?
Yeah, me too.
You had problems doing that? Maybe the URL has changed since last fall. So thank you very much. I will look at that. I'll find a new URL, because that case can be found in many different locations. And I'll reconnect it. So thank you very much. Any other questions or comments about Ron Corelli? Well, I've got about 3 minutes now to talk about labor relations. Next month, we're going to be, one of the cases we're talking about is the labor relations trilogy, where the Supreme Court of Canada in the 1980s said that freedom of association does not mean that labor unions have a right to strike. And then it's interesting, in the beginning, with the Dunbar case in Ontario, I think the courts thought that agricultural workers are being treated so unfairly. It was really unjust. And so they began to chip away at the labor relations trilogy without overturning it. But finally, in 2007, the labor relations trilogy was overturned by the Supreme Court of Canada in the BC Health case. So it's interesting, in your readings for next month, look at the trilogy that's on one of your readings for next month, and compare that to the to the BC Health decision, where, in part, the Supreme Court overruled itself, which does not happen very often. So it's quite fascinating. when, about 15 years ago, I was Associate Dean of Arts at York, and one of my jobs was labor relations with QP 3903. So I was involved in two collective bargaining sessions, both of which resulted in settlements at midnight and prevented a strike. But it made me realize that the results of collective bargaining really depend on the people on the negotiating committee, both on the union side and the labor side. It depends on personalities. I remember the very last day of negotiation, and everybody was very tense, and it looked like the likely outcome was going to be a strike. And my daughter, who was then 5 years old, she saw me looking very tense, and she said, "Daddy, what's wrong?" And I said, "Well, I'm afraid that we're not going to reach an agreement. There's going to be a strike tomorrow, and it's going to cause havoc for the students and the professors and a lot of bad will, and it's going to hurt the university." And she said, "Daddy, you tell those people, if they don't find a settlement, I will come and settle it for them." So I got into the collective bargaining session, and the union was over there looking very grim, and the management people were over here looking very grim. You could cut the air with a knife. It was just so tense. So I told everybody what my daughter had just told me, and everybody laughed. We reached an agreement. So it's little things like that have such a huge impact. Law has a huge impact. Personality has a huge impact. So in this program, the MPEL program, you're learning all kinds of things that will help you with your work, and all of it is necessary. Any questions or comments before we head to the absent?
The assignment for next class?
The assignment for next class.
Do you have anything to add to that?
The assignment, yes, the assignment for next class is comparing two cases. Right? It's your first case analysis assignment. What I want you to do is to find two cases where the judges treated the same kinds of factual situations differently. And it could be something like Russell and Snyder. Although most students, or it could be the local prohibition case and Russell. But most students choose something, they're very creative in terms of what they choose. Two different cases. And what I want you to do is very carefully analyze what the judges in the two different cases say about the same issues. And just give me your analysis of why their analysis was different. It's interesting, in some of the Supreme Court of Canada cases in the 1970s, and I think the assignment is mostly the division of powers cases. Yeah, don't get into the Charter of Rights cases, because we haven't gotten there yet. That's the next assignment. But for some of the division of powers cases later on, there was an argument between Laskin and Ritchie in terms of how Laskin had decided a previous case. And Ritchie would say, "Well, Laskin clearly decided this. He was in the majority, so this is what we have to go with." And Laskin would say, "That is not what I decided." it's a very interesting back and forth. Why do they misunderstand each other? Is it intentional? Is it because they read the words differently? What is your analysis? But I think you'll find that really interesting, and it'll help you in terms of being able to read these kinds of cases and make up your own minds what they mean. Okay? Does that help?
That's right.
Okay. That's great. We'll see you in the absent. Don't forget to take the French for Public Administration pamphlets if you need them. Thank you for the wonderful presentations today, and thanks for setting the stage for the presentations in March.
didn't hear it.